week of July 28th, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 457, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, for the moment, I'm Michael Giltz.
You say for the moment as if, you know, imminently you could be asked to leave.
It's a multiverse. I could go anywhere. But in fact, I'm heading back to New York. So we're recording early on Monday. You've got a phone meeting. I've got to head out of town. We've got a busy day. So we're still recording very, very early Monday morning, which means we may not get the information about Old Town Road. But let's just assume, I think, looking at the tea leaves, that it will be on top for a 17th week. I don't think there's another song that's quite big enough to dislodge it yet. So we promised we would say wow if it actually hit 17 weeks. So Sperling, please go ahead.
Wow.
Well done. Well done.
I was just talking about your use of the words delodge. I think it's dislodge.
Delodge, dislodge. Shakespeare made up words. We can make up words.
Yeah, but you know, he had an audience. Granted, it was a small audience in a round theater, but still.
Yes, we have a round podcast.
Good point. We do have an audience.
Yes, we have an audience. Absolutely. We have an audience and we have a show. And Old Town Road, if it's number one for 17 weeks, is sort of a great example of the era. Every era, when you look at a song, you can probably see how it identifies and typifies and symbolizes that area. Look at Old Town Road, starting on TikTok. You know, a 10-second little viral clips that kids create on their own, becoming viral there, switching over to actual, you know, radio play, the country versus rap versus pop argument. It doesn't get a video for weeks into its run at number one, and then it gets an all-star video. The guy who created the song and has his first shot of success comes out in the midst of all of this during, you know, Pride Month, June. You know, everything about this song is just so of the moment. It's crazy.
And I like the way he came out, too. He's like, did you listen to the song? Have you seen me? I thought I made it obvious.
Well, not that song. There was another song with some lyrics in it. But it wasn't that obvious to me. But anyway, congrats in advance to Old Town Road, which will now, of course, stop at 16 weeks. We can guarantee now that we have talked about it hitting 17 weeks, it won't. But maybe we'll get the news before the end of the show. But what else will we talk about this week?
Well, and just to note, we're recording so early that after
I'm not awake.
After we finish, I'm going to go wake up the rooster.
Yeah, I'm not awake.
Well, you know, before I wake up the rooster, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we celebrate Disney positively obliterating box office records, both domestically, internationally, and worldwide. Get it? I said internationally and worldwide.
Those are two different things.
I know. Meanwhile, underdog studio Sony tries to counter-program the Mouse House with a film for these things called adults. Well, the new Quentin Tarantino movie, I can't even say his name, it's so early. Quentin Tarantino, he's got a new movie out, but will it be a hit? You know what? It started off quite well. The battle between writers and agents continues. Two more agencies that belong to the Association of Talent Agencies signed the new WGA Code of Conduct, and yet this is the week some major talent decided, you know what, the writers are on the wrong track. Are they right or just focused more on what's best for them? On Inside Baseball, we've got a roundup of music stories. Will Vivendi really sell off Universal Music Group? And if the biggest stars of touring are really old, why are the biggest stars in streaming getting younger and younger? And since we stream, I want my youngness back. I don't think that's a word, but still, I want it. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's box office. And the reason I go slow is because for so long, I said last weekend's box office, but now it's last week's box office.
That's right. And we're the only ones in the world to talk about this. Everybody followed our lead on talking about worldwide box office. And now I predict within a year or two, they'll start following our lead and talk about the entire week because there's so much more money to talk about. We've got a link to ComScore in our show notes. We've also got a link to Box Office Mojo. We pull info from The Numbers, Deadline Hollywood, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, The New York Times, The LA Times, you, our listeners, we depend on you. And the number one movie around the world last week was The Lion King.
I'm shocked, I tell you.
Well, last week, The Lion King made $431 million. Those are bigger numbers than you'll hear from anybody else. They'll talk about the last 3 days and say it made $218 million worldwide. Or they'll talk about just North America and say it made $75 million. Well, put that in your pipe and smoke it. It actually made worldwide $431 million. It's now at $962 million worldwide, which means in about 2 minutes, it will pass the $1 billion mark.
Well, so really what I want to say is I always like doing this. Well, besides that, so you say it made $218 million
last last 3 days. Yeah.
Right. It made as much as that during the previous four days.
It's summertime, but there are lots of time of the year where weekday matters. The Christmas season, the Thanksgiving season, holiday weekends that appear on Monday or Friday or Wednesday or Thursday, the school break. So the Easter week, there's lots of times where more than Friday, Saturday, Sunday matters. And of course, most movies open up on Thursday anyway. So yes, let's look at the full week, and that tells you a very different picture. $431 million this week, just about to pass $1 billion worldwide. Yet another film from Disney that will dominate the world.
You think Jon Favreau is just like adding like entire museum wings onto his house now?
He's getting a lot of money for sure. At number two around the world is Noja, which is a Chinese animated film directed by Dumpling.
I saw that. It's a dumpling. I was like, well, he must mean something else, that the director made dumpling or likes dumplings.
That's the nickname of the director.
I want to be called wonton.
You got it.
Yeah, pizza. Pizza, my favorite food, pizza or ice cream. I got to come up with a good food nickname.
You come back to that with us. And Noja, very happy because it's spelled N-E-Z-H-A. Sometimes as one word, sometimes as two, but I was lucky enough to find a online YouTube video about the actual legend this film is based on. Noja is a little boy with superpowers, a famous Chinese legend. In fact, he battled the Monkey King at one point, but I would never have known how to pronounce it if I hadn't stumbled across that website that happened to have a video, happened to talking about the actual legend. So we always try and figure out how to pronounce certain names and directors and actors, it can be really hard. This one, we got a little bit lucky, but Noja opened up in China, $92 million on its opening week. That too was a record, the biggest opening ever for an animated film, the biggest single day for an animated film. So there you go. That movie's doing just great in China.
And you say it's about a nine-year-old that battled the Monkey King?
I didn't say he was nine, and this particular story may not include that. There are lots of adventures of Noja. I don't quite know what the plot of this particular one. I assume it's an origin story.
Okay, I only say that because, if that is the case, then I'm going to have to get a lawyer and, sue them for stealing my life story.
At number three around the world is Spider-Man Far From Home. It made $66 million last week. And yes, it passed the $1 billion mark. $1,036 million. Not a Disney film. So a rare non-Disney film to dominate the box office. But of course, it's Disney adjacent because it's part of the Marvel universe. At number four is Toy Story 4, another Disney film. $58 million last week. That's at $919 million and counting. We were sort of tentative about saying whether it would actually cross the $1 billion mark. But everybody else looking at the box office and how it's trending and the sort of legs this kind of movie gets, they're all saying, no, this one's a lock. So it made $58 million last week. It's going to have a pretty wide open thing from here on out. There's no big family films until Dora the Explorer, which doesn't look that good, actually. So I think Toy Story is going to be just fine worldwide and gross another $81 million, which will make that the fifth, the sixth. I mean, they're just piling up here.
I can tell you that when my kids look at a movie and go, oh, why did they make that movie?
Dora,
yeah. I'm like, it has boots. And they said, I know, I can see from the poster, but still.
Yeah. Yeah,
no, they love Dora the Explorer.
Yeah, they just did it. I think they got it wrong in terms of the age of the actors. They're just a little bit. They want to keep people who are old enough that they wouldn't age out, I think, was the idea, right away so they could make sequels. But I don't think it worked. At number five is Looking Up, another Chinese hit. This is about a Chinese father and son. We've talked about it before. An astronaut thinking back on his life with his dad. It made $46 million last week. It's made $107 million worldwide, most of that in China. So those are two new Chinese films that are doing well at the Chinese box office. Some rare good news for that country where seemingly every other film has been blocked from release. At number six is Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It made $40 million on its opening week, the best week opening so far for a Quentin Tarantino film. This is just in North America. We'll have to see how it does around the world. And of course, he's a big draw in Europe. We'll have to see. The audience scores are not great. I don't think they liked it as much as critics. I don't think I liked it as much as most critics. I had lots of issues with it. It was well made, well acted, but I never felt remotely involved. I wasn't bored, but I was never emotionally compelled by the movie. I have no problems with the ending as such. It sort of plays with history, just like Inglourious Basterds. You know, so if you're worried about it being a gore fest and really, no, don't worry. It's sort of more comic violence. You're not going to get horrored out by this movie. That's not the point of it. But there's lots of weird things going on with the film. And I would have to especially give kudos to the journalist who right away after seeing the movie called out Quentin Tarantino on its lame female characters.
Yeah, well, actually, I believe it was in Cannes where
right.
that happened.
Absolutely.
Yes. And, you know, you might recall my saying when I saw it in Cannes, I was like, you know what? Everybody's going gaga over this movie. But like you, Michael, I was kind of like, it's not a bad movie. It's not.
Our in-house film critic thinks it's horrible. Hated it. Aaron Rich really did not like it at all. Thought it was just a shambles. And I can't disagree with a lot of his complaints about why this, why that, choice here, the choice there, what the hell is the whole point of the movie? It's sort of a weird ode to an era of Hollywood that was a horrible era. Bad movies, bad TV shows were being made. The 70s was coming in with one of the great revivals, you know, considered the greatest era for filmmaking in the modern times, at least. And so the idea of like, oh, what a sad time when you're the era passing of crappy TV shows and crappy Italian movies and crappy this and crappy, you know, bloated Hollywood flicks. But it seems to have no sense of knowing what it's celebrating or what it's, you know, passing. It's okay to be into that era, but to have no sense of like, no, actually, it's not all bad news about the changing of the guard coming in Hollywood. So it's just there's a lot of weird stuff going on.
Yeah, you know, I read Kenneth Turan's review of the film, and I have to say that it was a review that made me appreciate the film more, but then I realized, well, I shouldn't need to read a review to appreciate the film.
Well, it's always nice to keep your mind open, or, you know, a second viewing can change your opinion or give you, you know, for me, my opinion has changed as I thought about the movie a little bit. I came out of it, I was like, it's okay. But over the next few days, thinking about it, I was like, oh, that didn't make any sense. That was dumb. This was poor. You know, it just doesn't track for me. So I've sort of downgraded it the farther away I've gotten from my actual view. And, you know, you go see a movie, you want to enjoy yourself.
Yeah. You know, look, I mean, it was I felt like it was a film with some really great moments in it and great scenes. And yet, everybody
why the dissing of Bruce Lee? Why did they make him such a joke? Quentin Tarantino would love Bruce Lee.
I think he does, but right. I think that's the way he sees him. And there's a scene with
you can't love him if you portray him as a blowhard who gets torn apart by a real man, you know, a real stunt man. You know, that's not love. So I'm not sure what was going on there. I mean, maybe it's historically accurate. I have no idea, but it just seems silly.
It did, but it was also one of the better scenes in the movie.
Except. There's a payoff in the scene. I assumed that they were there. There's a fight between Brad Pitt and Bruce Lee, and at one point a car comes into play. And I assumed it was a fake car. I assumed it was a prop, not an actual car. Otherwise, what happened is completely ridiculous to me. So I thought, oh, well, that's just a prop car or something. But then it turns out, no, that's an actual real car, in which case what happens doesn't make any sense.
Yeah,
I'm like, well, wait, whoa, what are you talking about? That's a real car? Like, that doesn't, it just doesn't, you know. The whole movie, I hate to spoil the movie, go see the film.
Should we talk about the Sony of it all here? Is this where we should mention Sony?
Well, there was a story in the LA Times saying, hey, here's a film for adults. It's not based on a tentpole. It's not a franchise. Will it make money? You know, will this be the last film made for adults ever? You know,
so, well, I don't know. You know, Ryan Fonder wrote the story. Mm-hmm. And I think what he was trying to point out is a couple things. One, hey, it's the middle of summer and
time to counter program all the big dumb summer movies. It worked with Dunkirk. It works all the time.
And that is exactly what he points out, actually. He points out, look, you know, people think it's a bad time, but keep in mind that Dunkirk and all the, he kind of lists all the movies there that do come out. But I think it was also a way, of course, let's face it, to write about a movie that everybody was, you know, a highly anticipated movie, and you're trying to sell newspapers, so they wrote about it.
Well, the Academy screening was sold out. You know, jam-packed Saturday night, which is not that wildly unusual. It happens. It happened for Rocketman, but we're going to do another screening. So, you know, of course, it's about Hollywood, so Hollywood's going to love it. You can imagine they will have affection for the film. We'll have to see.
It was also a way to write about Tom Rothman, the head of Sony, after, you know, took over after Amy Pascal was kind of pushed out after the big Sony hack, and a way to write about Sony and how Rothman, you know, kind of leading Sony hasn't had too many hits. Of course, this year is an exception with Spider-Man, as you just mentioned. And the question was, gee, he spent $90 million on this Quentin Tarantino movie. He's releasing it during summer. This is a big, big bet. And he even said in the, Rothman said in the piece, if this doesn't work, it's on my head.
Well, of course it is. Well, we don't care if he said it. Of course it's on his head. He made it happen. Yes, of course it's on his head. But that's okay. It's a safe bet. I think it's the biggest budget ever for a Tarantino film. It needs to gross $270 million worldwide to sort of be a wash, at least from the box office alone. I think that's a safe bet.
Well, and Rothman said he believes it will be Tarantino's biggest international hit to date, which very well might be true, given the fact that it is based very loosely on some real-life events.
Well, I don't think that helps it worldwide, the fact that it has a vague connection to the Manson murders. I think he means because it stars Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio.
Well, that too.
Yeah. At number seven around the world is Aladdin, another $21 million. This too has passed the $1 billion mark, $1.009 billion. So Aladdin is only the fifth live action Disney film of all time to pass the $1 billion mark. At number eight is The Secret Life of Pets 2, another $14 million last week. That's at $333 million worldwide. At number nine is The White Storm 2, Drug Lords. This is a Hong Kong action flick, a crime drama, $14 million it made last week. That's at $190 million and counting. At number 10 is Crawl. This is the Alligators Attack movie, $12 million it made last week. It's at $45 million and counting. It cost about $14 million to make, so this movie has tripled its budget. When you look down the list of all the films on our chart, except for the new movies that just opened up, we can't speak to them, of course, but except for Stuber, the Uber driver comedy, which is down there at number 13, that's at $27 million worldwide and counting. That one so far is not looking like a success story. It looks like it will probably fade out before it gets to heaven. It'll probably be okay when all is said and done, given all the sell-offs in other countries and ancillary. Exactly. But it is not a success story by any stretch of the imagination. Other than that, everybody else is a winner. The entire top 10 filled with winners. And number 11 is Yesterday. That's at $109 million. And number 12 is Annabelle Comes Home. That's at $207 million. And then we've got really four new movies here at the bottom. So everything through the top 12 is a hit film, or it has opened up so strongly it looks like it's going to be okay. So at number 14 is a new flick. It's Dancing Elephant. Oh my God, I almost called it a Chinese film, but it's a Taiwanese film. It's a comedy. Thank God I found that out at the last second.
Well, you will be loved in China if you do call it a Chinese film.
And I don't think anybody likes having their country confused with another country.
Yeah, although in China, of course, they consider Taiwan a part of their country.
That's right. This is a comedy. It's about a girl who goes into a coma at the age of 13, wakes up at 28. She's 28 years old and she's heavy. But she always wanted to be a dancer and she keeps pursuing her dream. So it's a lot of fat jokes. Ha ha, look at a girl trying to dance when she's big. We'll have to see if it's actually funny. But $5 million on its opening week, it does not look promising to me. I'm going to skip the next one because it's interesting. At number 16 is one of those one-off projects, you know, one night only. Andre Rieu's 2019 concert, Shall We Dance? Simulcast all over the world. It made $3.5 million. And number 17 is what I think is a Chinese drama about teen suicide called Over Again, where two boys, good-looking boys, go back in time to try and save a good-looking girl from committing suicide.
I guess there's only good-looking people in that movie.
Exactly. And jumping back up again is a Korean film, The King's Letters. This is a Korean drama. It opened up to $4 million. We don't know what it cost to make, but it's a decent opening for a serious period drama. It's about Sejong the Great. This is a ruler in Korea in the 1400s who seemed wildly progressive. Not great on religion, kind of vicious to the Buddhists and the Muslims, but other than that, a really progressive leader. This movie focuses on the fact that he created the phonetic Korean alphabet to make it easier for all classes to read and write.
The Han, you mean?
Yes. He also placed all classes in government. Like, he gave government jobs to everybody. He didn't have to just be part of the nobility. He supported inventions and people who invented things, even if they were from lower classes. And get this, I found this back in 1430. 689 years ago, he gave enslaved women 30 days off before they gave birth and 100 days of maternity leave. He get three more maternity leave for enslaved people back in Korea in the 1400s than you get in the United States today. He also gave enslaved men 30 days of paternity leave back in the
14th. I want proof.
It's in Wikipedia. It must be true.
Should be the name of a book.
If it's in Wikipedia, if it's Tuesday, it must be Belgium. If it's Wikipedia, it must be true. So that just blows my mind. But it sounds like a bit of a dull flick, you know. You watch the king invent an alphabet, but, you know, more power to them. And he sounds like a fascinating character, that's for sure. There is some box office news in North America. The Farewell has broken into the top 10. That's the Awkwafina film. It's doing great. It expanded to 135 screens, and it's made more money and chugging along. That's going to be a big player for a long time. Last 3 days, it made $1.5 million. It's at $3.6 million and counting. So it's got a long ways to go.
Yeah, and I would like to just point out, you said, you know, that Korean film, The King's Letter, seemed like a boring flick. A couple things. The reason I mention that is I saw a film called Honeyland, which I thought, oh, God, this is going to be – and I'm a beekeeper. I love beekeeping.
An aviary?
Well, I used to.
Oh, cool.
I used to. But, you know, kids, and then, you know, they're afraid of bees, so
– hive collapse, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. I thought, as much as I love beekeeping, this is just going to be a boring movie. It's about a beekeeper, a woman beekeeper she's got to be in her 50s, who's kind of the last of her kind,
great,
living in Macedonia.
Great reviews.
And I remember it premiering at Sundance, and I saw another film instead of it. It then wound up winning every award you could think of.
Right.
And I thought, oh, I guess I should have seen that film. Even so, I thought, oh, this is going to be a dry film. It is a beautiful movie, not only to look at, its cinematography is fantastic, but it is just a compelling story from start to finish. And you'd think, oh, but it's in Macedonian, or it's in Turkish, or it's in, you know, a Turkish dialect. Even so, there's very little dialogue that you actually need to read, because the story is just, it's, I don't even know where to begin in this story. Nothing I say would do it justice. And it's a documentary. It's all true.
Mm-hmm. Well,
this is a true story. And they spent, the filmmakers, a man and a woman, spent 3 years following this one woman around and her mother, and her very elderly 85-year-old mother, living in a part of Macedonia with no electricity, no running water. It's an unbelievable movie. Well worth seeing. It's 85 minutes long. Trust me, you'll thank me after you see it.
Well, it's gotten great reviews. I look forward to checking it out. It's not playing anywhere near me right now here in Birmingham, though we did just get the Toni Morrison documentary, which looks a little noble. However, I said any movie can be exciting. You can make a movie about an ant farm, and it can be exciting. I said The King's Letters looked like it was a pretty dull film, because every review and consumer comment on the film said it was a pretty dull film. So,
well,
you know,
okay,
you can make an action film about, you know, blowing up the world, and it can be dull, you know. So I just said it was dull, not because of the subject matter, but because all the reviews said it was dull.
Well, and the reason I bring up the Honeyland,
that's fine, it's great, yeah,
is because you brought up The Farewell, and all of a sudden I'm getting in my inbox over there at Celluloid Junkie, which, by the way, apparently I've checked, Michael, so you'll be happy to know I do actually check email every once in a while.
Once a year.
But I'm I'm getting once a year, but I'm getting this new email every Sunday called the Specialized Top 15 Weekend Box Office Estimates. And I'm looking at it, and I'm like, oh, great, Honeyland is number one. And I'm thinking it must have made a mint. Well, it's made $30,000, but it's only on two screens.
It's the per screen average that they're doing, ranking it by.
Right, and I'm like, what, The Farewell made 1.5. And yes, I like turn around, I said, wait a second, they're not doing a – They're doing a special way of ranking their films. They better not start doing weekly box office. That's patented, copyrighted, that's trademarked. Right. That's, we have that, my friend.
That's right. Yeah, if you look at the chart, and we have it in our show notes, you'll see that the David Crosby documentary, which I've heard is quite good, did not expand very well. It's now on 11 screens and doing fairly poorly. So that's not going to have traction, but there are other movies doing really, really well in the specialized market. That's for sure. However, we did want to talk about Disney. We're a long time on the box office here, so we got to get going. But Disney set all sorts of records. It has the highest grossing year ever in North America, the highest grossing internationally ever, and the highest grossing year worldwide. And it's only July. I mean, that is just stunning, you know. And what does Disney have left? They have Star Wars, that's coming out. They have Frozen 2, that's coming out. So those could both be billion-dollar movies. And it looks like Toy Story and Toy Story 4 and, of course, The Lion King are going to join the list that they already have. So they just keep adding up the money. $7.67 billion worldwide, that's a new worldwide record, and that's in July, and that's for any studio. They've crossed $5 billion internationally, the first studio to ever do that. And this, none of this includes Fox titles. So Disney is really tearing it up.
Well, and you know what, Michael, you just keep talking about Disney. I just say, let it go.
That's right.
That's a Frozen reference.
Very,
you get that?
Very good.
Do you want me to sing it for you?
I would love for you to sing it to me. But first, I would like to talk about...
China?
China, yes.
Yeah. Well, there's not a lot to talk about, really, because, you know, their box office is down. Unlike Disney, their box office is going in the wrong direction.
Well, both North America and Chinese box office are down because of Quentin Tarantino, because of The Lion King, because of the big success. Actually, North America has now reduced its you know, it's the second highest grossing year of all time so far. It's 6% behind last year, which was the highest grossing year of all time. So let's not pretend that the second highest grossing year ever is anything but good news. But yes, China has more substantial problems. It does have two movies doing well that just opened up. However, theater chains are closing, right? They're consolidating. Basically, they expanded too fast.
Well, they haven't consolidated yet. Oh, okay. They haven't. They're on their way to consolidate. Look, this is exactly what happened in the 1980s in the U.S. It's exactly what happened in the 90s and 2000s as well, actually, in the U.S., but also in Europe. You get to a point with every market like this where you overbuild, mm-hmm. you start putting theaters in places that really can't support them. And you pay too much to build the theaters, and the rents are too high, and the business just doesn't work. And so circuits, the businesses that they find themselves in that position, wind up having to sell out to other more successful circuits.
So what specifically is happening in China?
Well, you've got a couple things. You have a drop in viewership, so that's number one. So you know, everybody kind of
it's not as high as all. It's not growing by 30%, which of course was an unreasonable expectation forever. Yeah,
right, exactly. And then rents have gone through the roof because people hear, "Oh, movie theater, let's raise the rent," which doesn't always make sense. In fact, there is one industry veteran, Wang Zheng, who said, "Look, you know, it used to be that he controlled." Omnijoy, which is in certain parts of the country had 90% of the good cinemas. Uh-huh. And he this is very telling, this rent and this amount of money. The rent that he was paying in his part of the eastern part of the country was roughly 800,000 won or $116,000
Yeah, stick to won because it's easier to follow.
Okay, yeah, but no, I just wanted to say $116,000 per year for his cinemas. Okay,
so about $10,000 a month.
About $10,000 a month, 800,000 won. Okay, so going back to Juan for a second, there were some theaters that he would say, "Well, you know, I'll open there," and then he would be outbid by somebody who was willing to pay 1.2 million won per year,
so 50% more.
Yeah, and he's looking at it, going, "Well, wait a second. That location can only make 400,000 won per year. Why would you pay three times that amount?
You certainly shouldn't pay 800,000, not if that's the most you can make. So people right. were building too expensive places for too much money with too high a rent in locations that couldn't support them. That's when we got beyond the first tier cities. You get into second and third tier towns, you're going to have lower rent and lower ticket prices because the people won't be able to afford to go, and you got to make it a reasonable business. And that didn't happen, did it? So for the 12 months through June of 2019, as many as 470 theaters have shut down, twice as many as 1 year earlier, either for good or for what they call renovations.
Yeah, which is another way. And by the way, that was when I was in Portugal, you'd hear all these stories about restaurants that would, they're still open. Yeah. They're just under renovations during the financial collapse. Everybody
for 14 months.
Yeah,
until
for it like
became
14 years.
A CBS, yeah. One casualty exactly. was the mid-sized theater chain Perfect World Cinema. They closed down earlier this year and sold off more than 30 theaters that they operated.
Yeah, and you see Huawei Brothers, they are, you know, they're also a production company, but they are selling their projection equipment to a leaseback company. So they're not closing their theaters, mm-hmm. At least not all of them. They're just saying,
they're
you know,
selling
what,
off the future, though.
Yeah, they're basically saying, well, we can't afford this. Sell the equipment, and then we'll lease it back
and hope to
stabilize.
Yeah, no, that's not a good sign.
Right, exactly.
That's like when you sell off your headquarters and lease it back from the new owners. Yeah, that's not a good thing.
Yeah, well, what I think is interesting is that, you know, when you're talking about rent that is $116,000 a year, or, you know, let's say $400,000 a year, this, you know, a couple locations can only make $400,000 per year. Well, that's like $80,000 a year. Think about that.
What?
For one location, one cinema, only making roughly $80,000 per year. Uh-huh. That's what this one, I mean, that's, it just goes to show you when we're
that's
talking
a very
about the
small location with a lot lower ticket prices.
Right.
And you're also paying people less, you know, your operating expenses should be less. China expanded yes. to 60,000 screens, the most screens in any market in the world. Maybe they've got too many. They've certainly expanded too fast, and there's going to be some consolidation. That's what's going to happen. So this is a normal, natural cycle. It happened in the U.S. It happened in Europe. Now it's happening in China. Perhaps speed it
By
up.
By the way, mm-hmm. happened in India.
Of course.
So, yeah.
By the way, speaking of India, I have not seen any India titles on ComScore or heard about any Indian films in weeks now. What the heck is going on? I feel like they're not reporting to ComScore, or some communication has collapsed, because I can't imagine no Indian film has opened up in the last 4 weeks.
Well, keep in mind that in India, unlike many other parts of the world, it is the producer that controls, not the studio. It's usually a producer that controls the
yeah.
each film.
Yeah, but we've had that info.
The reporting of box office can be very touch and go.
Right, but why has it been a month since we've heard of an Indian film opening up? Have they all been disasters and they don't want to talk about it? Something's wrong.
I think it's just the reporting structure there. I would not doubt that it is
but we've always
harder
had that.
To
we've
get
always,
the grosses.
It is, and we've always had the reporting structure, but we've usually seen Indian films in the mix. And it's
but
been
are they
weeks
Indian
now.
Are they Indian films coming from India? Meaning, are the grosses coming from India, or are they coming from overseas, where it might, meaning China, where it might be a little easier to get those grosses?
No, I'm talking about India films opening in India. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, something's wrong here. We should not be missing out on that entire market. But there's also something wrong with the writers and the talent agencies. They're fighting.
Yeah, constantly. They're constantly bickering. Well, at least they have been over the past year. And what they're bickering about, for those of you, you know, who are just joining us already in progress, the writers, screenwriters and television writers, they don't like that their agents,
are
the agents that represent
them
are actually packaging television series and not working for them, as you say, and getting packaging fees rather than taking 10% of their salary, which you'd think, hey, well, give me my 10% back. However, that means that the agents aren't working in the best interest of their own clients. Right. Oh, by the way, some of these agencies are also producing their own shows and producing their own films through affiliated production companies, which is a bit of a, you know, conflict of interest.
Right. Agencies are making their money by packaging shows. They're making money by launching their own production companies, and they're making money now by going public, all of which means that they have all sorts of things that they're doing that have nothing to do with helping to make sure a writer gets the most money possible and has the longest, best career. And since the writer has hired you to represent them, not you, they're a little miffed about that. However,
and remember, a couple months ago, the Writers Guild of America basically turned to all the writers and said, you need to fire all of your agents. And the writers did. Most of the writers did fire their agents.
Absolutely. Well, they had to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now, slowly, so there's been this negotiations, although the negotiations keep breaking down.
Well, because the writers are saying, change what you've been doing for the past three decades and how you make most of your money.
And the agents are saying, well, we could, no, we don't want to do that. Actually, we don't want to do that at all. And then they kind of give in, well, what if we give you 1% of packaging fees? And the writers go, oh, yeah, no, change it. So what we have now, there's a couple developments in this story, which seems to be, as you suggested, Michael, you said, look, this is not going to be solved anytime soon. And I agreed with you. And guess what? It wasn't solved anytime soon, and it keeps going. So a couple things, a couple new developments. It's an ongoing saga. We have the Writers Guild of America versus the ATA, and a couple of these guild members or members of the ATA have said, okay.
Two medium-sized talent agencies have broken with the ATA and signed a new code of conduct required by the Writers Guild of America. Buchwald and Kaplan Staller, they're mid-sized agencies, they're members of the ATA. Pantheon is also a smaller ATA member that signed, and The Verve is a non-ATA member that is among one of dozens that have signed on to this new code of conduct. We're approaching 100 different talent agencies, three of them who are members of the ATA. Two of them are pretty good mid-sized companies now, Buchwald and Kaplan Staller. Those are two pretty big names, and they agreed to forego packaging fees and or creating their own production company. And they've tweaked a little thing so everybody gets to benefit from whatever new agreement is made. But they've done a couple things. They've said, okay, we need to be able to see all your contracts, invoices, and deal memos unless a writer objects in writing. That placated some of the concerns they had. They've expanded the code to run for 5 years. And they've also added some arbitrators approved by some of these companies who said, hey, we want some more arbitrators and some people we know. And those last two in particular were big objections to some of these people. And now we've had two good size agencies cave or say, hey, you know what, this is the way to go forward, and they've done it. And so I thought, wow, this is big news. You know, this could really lead to a domino effect. Two bigger names signing on with the Writer Guild Code of Conduct. Good heavens. Feels like the writers must be energized and excited and have a sense of unity and purpose because, wow, change is happening and they're starting to really win big.
Have you watched CNN, Fox News, or MSNBC, or any BBC? Have you? Nobody's agreeing with anybody in this day and age. That's just not the way it's done anymore. You have to have conflict.
Apparently that's so, because just as I thought, wow, writers might start to go, hey, this is actually working. It's only been a few weeks, for God's sake. Instead, we have a WGA election looming, and there are a lot of anti-strike people who are backing Phyllis Nagy, if I'm saying her name right. And these are big, big names. Some 300 people signed up on a letter saying we're backing her. We think this is not the way to go. They're being too tough. They need to negotiate, as if there's some way to negotiate packaging fees. Either you do it or you don't. But they're saying, right, no, we're not happy. We don't like the way things are going. And they probably did this before those two agencies signed. Because
quite frankly, all of those agencies signing doesn't mean anything. Buchwald, Kaplan Staller, doesn't matter.
Well, and if every single agency other than the big four signs, and then artists and then writers and talent start signing with them, and suddenly they're not available anymore to the big four, it will matter. So yes,
that
it
is
does
true.
Matter. But the big names who said, we don't care what happens in the future, are Shonda Rhimes, Ryan Murphy, Ava DuVernay, Greg Berlanti, John Wells. They all think the WGA should play nice. They're all unhappy about the direction of negotiations. Some 300 people signed on to this public letter saying, we're backing Phyllis Nagy and we're not happy with the way things are going. We should be negotiating, not suing. That's what we need to do. And so,
right, and basically the lawsuit that the WGA filed against the ATA and the agencies is basically saying, hey, you guys are not necessarily colluding, but there's some antitrust issues here.
And we hired you to represent us, and you're not doing that.
Right.
You have no interest in doing what's best for us.
And the current board believes that to gain some leverage, they had to go to court because the ATA wasn't negotiating at all.
Well, the ATA sued them, and they sued back. It was the ATA that sued first.
Right. Ooh.
Yeah.
this did is it like first. Greedo versus Han Solo.
Right.
Uh, So, but here's why I bring up the it doesn't matter thing. Of packaged series last year, or actually in general, William Morris Endeavor and CAA were involved in 80% of all packaged series. So
that's meaning, why those are the big four.
Right. No, but meaning what I'm trying to say is, so Don Buchwald, which doesn't package series anyway, okay, they don't do that. That's not their specialty. And that's not something they're even well versed in. For them saying, yeah, well, we won't do it. Well, okay, you're not doing it now anyway.
Well, yes, but if people start to sign with them and say, I don't want to be with William Morris Endeavor because they don't give a damn about me or my career or getting me the most money, so why the hell am I paying them? If those people, if Ava DuVernay and Ryan Murphy said, hell, maybe I should be signing with Buchwald, they actually want to represent me and get me the most money, then the walls will fall. That's
but
the
here's
point.
The thing.
Of course, the big four, it doesn't matter because the ones doing it the most aren't involved yet. Of course, they're the ones who are going to resist the most. But if big name writers say, screw you, you don't care about me, I'm going with this mid-sized guy who's going to treat me like a god because they're so happy to have me. You know how happy they'd be to sign John Wells or Greg Berlanti? They'd
oh,
fall
yes, I
over
do.
Themselves. And as soon as that happens, instead, you have all the big names who have all the cushy lives already, who have all the success saying, oh, we can't be bothered with the future. Who cares? We're making money. That's I can't
well,
help
let's
having
just take
that
John
attitude.
Wells, for instance. Actually, let's take every writer. And let's say they sign with Abrams or Buchwald or – and by the way, this is merely a way to describe packaging. So just follow me here. Let's say they all sign with those agencies. Okay, so all no writers are now available to the big four, William Morris, ICM.
They're out of business.
CAA. Well, they're out of business. Well, yeah, I mean, that's another story, but I'm just trying to simplify it here. If you're Don Buchwald and Associates or Abrams Artists, you still can't package because you don't
right.
have all of the pieces.
No, you can't package because it's against the rules. You're not allowed to. And here is a story about it. Here is David Shore trying to sell The Good Doctor, and he's got this show that turns out to be a big hit, and he tells his agency, I don't want you to package it. That's not going to help my damn show. And they're like, screw you, says William Morris Endeavor. Screw you.
Well, wait a second. Here's the interesting part uh-huh. about this, because his own agency said, all right, sure.
Yes, because he's David Shore, and he has the
right. And ICM said, okay, fine. It was the other talent agency, William Morris Endeavor, representing another part of the package because ICM and William Morris Endeavor was going to split the packaging fees here that said, well, okay, but...
Yes, if you're Quentin Tarantino, you can make a deal that gives you your actual negative back to you in 30 years. But when you're not Quentin Tarantino and you're not David Shore, you can't even convince one company to do what you want, much less all of them. So he failed, didn't he?
David Shore?
Right.
No, he actually succeeded.
Because
basically, ICM said, no, we're not going to take a packaging fee. William Morris Endeavor threatened to, quote unquote, blow up the deal. Mm-hmm. And what David Shore was saying is, how are you going to blow up the deal? You're not my agent. We'll just find other people to do this.
But he had to risk everything and risk everything and possibly infuriate talent agencies that he needs to work with down the road on other projects just to make something that should happen as a matter of course. This is not an example of the system working well. This is an example of how crazy it is that he's got a show and he wants to make it happen. And William Morris Endeavor's like, we will bury you. That's ridiculous. Well,
but and the reality is, this is the reason MCA, remember MCA Universal?
Uh-huh.
Well, one of the A there, agency artists.
Yes.
Yeah. This isn't even supposed to be happening. This is like, this was already, you know, agencies were already told, look, either be production companies or be agencies, but you can't be both. This was like a loophole that they found decades ago.
And The Good Doctor is an example of how crazy the system is. It's not an example of the system working well. It's an example of how ridiculous it is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. No. I mean, it worked well for David Shore.
It did not work well. He had to fight and yell and scream to make something happen that should happen as a matter of course.
What's interesting, though, that I found is that in this,
attitude is, well, it doesn't matter because the big agencies haven't signed. Well, it doesn't matter because those mid-sized guys can't package anyway because they don't have all the pieces. They shouldn't be packaging all the pieces because they shouldn't be packaging. And it does matter because if the big agencies find themselves losing their clients and losing money, they will wake up and go, wow, I guess maybe the world has changed and we need to change with it.
Well, one of the things that let's say they lose all the writers, right? All these big four.
Uh-huh. They have. They've been fired by every writer. 98% of the writers. They have lost the writers. So that's already happened.
I'm playing a what if.
It's not a what if. They have lost every single writer they had. Virtually every writer has fired them. They do not represent them. They will not make any money from them if the writers hold firm, unlike all the big jerks who have already worth hundreds of millions of dollars.
I'm going to take it a step further. Uh-huh. I'm going to say that they all go and sign with Don Buchwald and Associates. They sign with Abrams. And those writers are taken off the table, not just
They are off the table.
But yeah, right. But they can always go back right now, correct? Unless they sign with one of these agencies that has agreed to the code of conduct.
Or decide they don't need an agent anyway.
Correct. Although let's not go down that road for a second. Just follow me here. I think you'll like where this is going. What you're saying is that if those writers go and sign with one of those agencies that have signed up with
one
the code of conduct.
One of the nearly 100 agencies that have agreed to it, yes.
Then it would be impossible for the big four to do packaging because now they're missing one of the pieces.
Okay.
In other words, they don't have the writers, effectively, which is where packaging generally starts from. It starts from the writers.
It's the person who creates the show.
Right, exactly. What I would say is, well, yes, what they would do is they instead of taking 100% of the packaging fees, they take a portion of the packaging fees. What I found interesting is that William Morris came back and said, oh, well, we were going to, cancel the packaging fee. We just had to let our clients know that they would have to, give up their usual 10% of their fees because, we wouldn't be getting a packaging fee. So they would have to forego 10% of their salary. So when we tell them that they're getting paid $100,000 per episode, it's now really only $90,000 because we don't get a packaging fee, which I thought was interesting that they gave up the 10% when they were getting a packaging fee.
Well, of course, because they were getting a lot more.
Exactly.
They didn't do it out of kindness.
No, not at all. No, this was like one way for, I'm sure that the agencies believe, I know the agencies believe that
they
this
said,
was one
yeah,
way to.
Yeah, you can have 10% here. We're getting 40% there, which is a lot more. We're going to get a $4 million rather than your $30,000. So yeah, you keep that chump change while we take the big pile.
And isn't it great that, well, look, we're not taking 10% from you. Aren't you so happy with us?
Yeah. That's not a big deal. That's a big whoop. That's what I say.
Okay, I see what you're trying to do. You're trying to tell me, in your very subtle way, that it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. I think I said that in one breath, by the way. Our first story, the Toronto Film Festival announced a clutch of high-profile debuts for its annual event, held there every September. Tom Hanks in that Mr. Rogers movie that you were talking about last week, mm-hmm. Michael. Christian Bale and Matt Damon in Ford versus Ferrari. That's kind of what I, every time I walk outside my house every day, I kind of go, which should I drive, the Ford or the Ferrari? Every day. Nicole Kidman
and the
Goldfinch.
And the answer is the Ford.
And ironically, it's usually the Toyota. The 20-year-old Toyota, I might add. Nicole Kidman in The Goldfinch, which, by the way, is that a good book? Should I read that book?
It's well thought of.
Okay, so you haven't read it either? Okay. Joaquin Phoenix in Joker and many, many others up there in Toronto. Venice responded with, oh yeah, well, you're going to book all those for your little festival? Well, our competing festival, which takes place pretty much at the same time, we're going to book a whole bunch of TV shows. Yeah. The first news to leak was the world premiere of two TV shows, a cocaine drama called 000. And that's the number of zeros that you get to put after the
That's from the creators
figures.
Of Gomorrah, yeah.
Yes. And season two of Jude Law's The New Pope, which wouldn't it be like the kind of new pope since the new pope was last season? Anyway, Venice is sure to have some glitzy films, but it's a sign of the times when TV shows can be a big get for a film festival. Indeed, Venice continued to embrace Netflix and Amazon, seeing that as Cannes loss, the Cannes Film Festival's loss. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, Venice did announce their full lineup, but the first news to leak out was about television, and that's kind of amazing, and that's they're getting a lot of blowback, people saying, some unions and some other people saying, why are you showing movies that aren't being shown in theaters? Why are you showing product that's not going to get a theatrical release? That your job is supposed to be to celebrate film, and film means theatrical release.
Well, basically, it's and this is the International Union of Cinemas, UNIC, one of their points is, look, if you're going to show a film and kind of promote the film and celebrate a film, then it should be available for everyone to see, subscribers of a certain, subscribers of a certain platform. You're forcing the issue. You're basically picking winners, picking commercial winners by doing that.
Well, but of course, the cost of a month of one of those services is far less than a cost of a single movie ticket, or is about the same. You know, you can see one movie or you can see 20 movies if you buy a monthly fee. So it's not like they're rising up for the people. You know, it's more of a premium exclusive experience to see a movie in a theater than to just simply rent, you know, monthly fee of Netflix or HBO or Amazon or whatever it may be. So they're
keep in mind, this is UNIC speaking, and Netflix is not available in all of the territories that it represents.
Well, I'm just saying yeah. UNIC is not speaking up for the little guy. You know, they make the, oh, it's so unfair, you're not letting people see them. It's like, no. You just want movies shown in theaters.
Yes,
right. You have to feel like Venice is sort of with the world today, whereas Khan and these guys are trying to close their eyes to the world as it exists. You know, their movies are content is being created, and it's not always going to movie theaters. You know, if you want to run a film festival and show the best movies and TV shows in the world, you can't ignore the movies that are only going to, you know, that are only going to be shown in, you know, cinemas. You'd be ending up not having half of the best movies. It'd be like having the Emmy Awards and not finally acknowledging cable, right? For a long time, they wouldn't let cable shows be eligible for the Emmys, and it would have looked stupid. Eventually, they had to cave and say, all right, we got to include
and
HBO.
And now look at what happened. Now, cable is taking over.
Well, exactly. So if you're going to have a film festival and ignore most of the great films being made that year because they're not getting a theatrical release, you're going to look pretty outdated and absurd.
Well, you know what? Universal City Studios ignored the fact that they owed some people some money, actually, for quite a while. And now they lost a round in court against the creators of the TV show Columbo. Yep, they actually did screw over talent, the talent behind Columbo. They screwed them out of a chunk of that very profitable show's money. But one more question, Your Honor, a disheveled Inspector Columbo might have asked. Exactly how much money are we talking about? I don't know why all of a sudden I sound like that. But, well, a team of accountants went to work and they sharpened their pencils and they just reported to the court that the total amount of money that was lost in interest.
Money and interest. Yeah. You really got lost there. They said
it comes to $77 million. How do you like go, we just haven't made that much. We're not that profitable. And that's just the money that accountants have found.
And that's just the money that those people deserve. It's not the total profits, of course. It's just their share of the total profits. And instead, they say, oh, we lost money.
Yeah, well, that's less than the nine figures the creators were hoping for, but still looks, you know, it's like a pretty big lottery jackpot to the rest of us. The judge will make a final ruling soon, and the whole mess is sure to be appealed, if possible. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's always good when things go to court and we get the facts and we get to see people win when they've been screwed over. That home improvement case, which actually helped influence the Columbo case based on some of the rulings that happened in that one years ago, that finally was settled out of court, of course, because they hate having things become legal rulings. They hate having their books opened. And Columbo's well along the path here, and they have no reason to settle. They've said repeatedly, we don't want to settle. We want our money. We want a court ruling. So hopefully this one will continue all the way through.
Yeah, you know what studios and networks hate? Precedent. That's for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, it's funny because when you really look at residuals like this that now amount to $77 million, and of course that does include some interest, right about now, I mean, that show was in the 70s, so we're talking about 40 years old. If you saw some of the paychecks, some of the residuals checks that these talent get, you'd laugh because they're like $1.50, $10, you know, because they're so old. Mm-hmm. And so for it to amount to $77 million means that a lot of money was made, you know, very early on that some interest is due on.
Well, I think you're talking about like residuals for an actor who appears on the Rockford Files or some old ad. And so it gets shown on a really small cable channel with an audience of, you know, 40,000. And right. So, you know, yeah, you get a $4 check and you giggle at it, but those pennies add up. But that's just somebody with a very small amount of kickback from a show in syndication. It's not like the lead actors or the creative talents. So, you know, those checks are really for people who are on the margins. You know, you appeared in a guest spot in a show once briefly. Yeah.
Hey, I'm living on the margins. Send me a check. But now, wait a second. I'm looking here and I'm scrolling back and forth over my show notes looking for the next big deal or big whoop story. And I realize I can't find any.
Well,
there are none.
That's because we've recorded so early. We missed all the Monday news.
Oh, you know what? We got to stop recording so early. Well, let me ask the rooster what the rooster has.
Why don't you move on to Inside Baseball?
Well, okay, but Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We explain what they mean for the business, and more importantly, how they affect you. And here's how they affect you. I'm just going to skip right to the part that I love. You're not going to be able to buy concert tickets anymore to old fogies, because they're going to be scalped by the old fogies themselves.
Well, you've skipped over the first story.
I know, but I love that stuff.
All right.
Okay, well, so yeah, let's talk about this first story about Vivendi, because my question is, the multinational corporation Vivendi even trying to sell a chunk of Universal Music Group? We've been talking about it, but is it actually happening, or are they just trying to figure out how much it's worth?
Well, that's what I feel like, because more and more people are wondering, are they really going to sell it? Because the news came out and the revenue from Universal is up 20% during the first half of 2019. It hit some $3.7 billion. It was perhaps the brightest spot in the entire Vivendi Corporation. Universal Music Group dominates the market. They just signed Taylor Swift. They just broke Billie Eilish. I mean, I guess if...
Well, they can glue Billie Eilish back together. She's quite young. She'll recover.
And I mean, if you're going to buy low and sell high, well, yes, this is the time to sell because it's pretty damn high right now. But, it just seems like, why exactly are you selling them? Do you not feel like music works into your portfolio enough? Is it feel that far afield? But of course, they're not trying to sell off the entire Universal Music Group. They just want to sell off a chunk of it and still keep control. But why do that when it's turning out money? But buy low, sell high, I guess. And maybe they're just trying to find out what it's worth. Maybe they just want to find out, you know, what's this sucker worth? But when you go through the motions and you start to hit numbers, maybe Apple or Amazon will step up and go, you know what? We'll buy the whole damn thing for this amount. And that might.
Well, and that's one way of, yeah, as you say, declaring worth or mm-hmm. kind of finding out worth, and then you can go borrow against that.
Right. That's true. But, they've been saying they're serious and they want to sell off a chunk of it. And of course, if the right buyer comes along, they'd sell off the whole thing. But, surely there are other ways to get an estimate of your value without pretending you're going to sell it. You don't have to pretend to sell it in order to find out what it's worth so you can get a loan, can you?
No, you look at revenue.
Right, you look at revenue. But yeah, of course, so, I mean, that seems unnecessary.
You know, revenue for recorded music is way down. And in fact, everyone knows the one place musical acts can still make money and make a lot of money in this digital streaming age is, you know, actually performing live, performing in concert. And one snapshot looks pretty good. Billboard's list of the top acts worldwide for the month of June, it's pretty diverse. Half of them are legacy acts. And I cannot believe I'm about to say this. Spice Girls.
They're a legacy.
That's right. Spice Girls. They are a legacy now. I actually felt my back, crack when I said that. Paul McCartney, of course. Dead and Company.
The Grateful Dead, but now renamed.
The Grateful Dead. Elton John and the Rolling Stones are all in the top 10. They've been around for, well, literally ages because they are aged. But you know who's also up there is Ed Sheeran at number 2. BTS at number 5. Ariana Grande at number 7, and this Lady Gaga person at number 10. Okay, Hootie and the Blowfish
are
number 11.
She's only been around for a decade, by the way, Lady Gaga. Her first album came out in 2008. So you think, oh, wow, she's a legacy act. No, she's kind of new.
Wow. Shawn Mendes is number 12, by the way. Mm-hmm. Hootie and the Blowfish, beating them out at number 11. And so, yes, legacy acts are big, but a lot of young talent is out there, and they're bringing in fans.
Yeah, I mean, I looked at that list, and I thought, well, that's a great mix, There's young people, there's classic acts, and I feel like that's a great sign. But before I was ready to pop the cork and celebrate, along comes Tim Ingham of Music Business Worldwide. I like his work a lot. We look at Music Business Worldwide regularly. He does a weekly column for Rolling Stone, at least one a week. And he took a step back and looked at the touring biz for the entire first half of 2019, not just the June snapshot, but the entire first half. And he did a column in Rolling Stone and on his website. And he points out that the biggest acts from the first half of 2019, their average age is 55. With Grandpa Elton on top of the grosses and almost on top of age. He's 72, and Bob Seger is 74. He just sort of edges him out. I guess that song used in Quentin Tarantino's movie helped Bob Seger get up there. Weirdly, Ingham points out a fun fact. The age of the top touring acts are getting older and older, but the age of top recording artists, he looks at the top albums and looks at the artists who have put them out and says, well, how old are they? Those are getting younger. So the biggest acts that tour are getting older, and the biggest acts that are hits are getting younger in terms of recording and streaming. Does that make any sense? Why would that happen?
Well, there's a couple things going on here. The first is that, of course, promoters and concert venues and, you know, just everybody in the chain, okay? Everybody in that chain wants to make more money. And you make more money by selling out the Hollywood Bowl, by selling out Madison Square Garden, by holding concerts where the ticket price is, you know, an average of $250. Well, you can't do that if you're, you know, touting a small act or an act, you know, an on the rise act like Billie Eilish. You know, Billie Eilish is not going to command $250 a ticket. Really, it's kind of like,
well, I think it's just rock and roll is getting older. That's all. And this is the first.
Well, that's true too. That is true too.
These guys aren't going away. We thought you'd be a young act and then you disappear, and you're like, well, the biggest touring acts are getting older. Well, yes, they are, because time marches on. It's not the Rolling.
I remember seeing in 1987 David Bowie perform at Giant Stadium, which doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
And everybody's like, he's still going at it at 40.
Exactly.
And I'm like, oh my God, 40. I wish I could be 40 again.
Well, you didn't think that at the time, but
no.
Yeah. So yeah, acts are getting older and they're still great draws on tour. That is not a bad thing that Elton John and Bob Seger and the Rolling Stones, et cetera, and U2 and Bruce Springsteen are still big, big acts worldwide. Tina Turner, if she wanted to tour again, she'd make a lot of money. So that's cool. But
well, she does it. You know, everybody said she does it for love, but she said, baby, what's love got to do with it? Show me the money.
There you go. But the recording acts are getting younger. That's part of the fact that there's so much more access to music, the ability to make music that can stream and that can hit. You don't have to have a record deal. You can be, you know, Old Town Road. You can be Lil Nas X, and you've got yourself a big worldwide smash happening before you even have a record label. You know, so I think the fact that anybody can record music. You can be Lord in your bedroom. You can be a young act in Australia or New Zealand or, you know, Africa or anywhere you want to be and record music that sounds good and can post it online. That just means the level of entry is so much lower that you're seeing a lot more young people jump into there, and that's streaming and where it's at. So I think those people will mature into the touring acts. You know, I don't think it's like, oh, well, there's some weird disconnect. It's like, no. It's easier than ever to become a hit songwriter, and your career, if you're good live, will last longer than ever. So those are two really good positives. And when you look at June, I think you can see the future there. Legacy acts aren't going to go away, but young acts are going to do really well too.
Well, when I went to see Hugh Jackman, I was shocked at a couple things. Just how expensive it was.
How much did you pay?
I do not want to say. I did not pay what they were asking because, you know, I was last minute. And
well, what was the face value? That's not what you paid.
Face value, $250 per ticket.
Where were your seats?
Actually, not bad. There's like the golden seats, and mine were right to the left of that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, not in the, you know, just a little left of center.
How far away were you from the stage? How many rows?
Well, it's the Hollywood Bowl.
I don't really know.
You know, two, three sections back.
Okay.
And those golden seats are right there because, long story short, the acoustics are horrible at the Hollywood Bowl, but in that section, the acoustics are pretty good. And so even though they're a little further back, they're not right on the stage, and they're not the section right behind the section that's right on the stage. There are three sections back. The acoustics are better, and you get, you know, a better view.
Right. Well, this brings us to a blast from the past. Our ticket prices too high? Heck yeah. It used to be we blamed scalpers. It was all their fault. Now we can just blame the acts themselves and dynamic pricing. But remember the good old days just a few years ago? That was when artists used to hide the fact that they were charging a premium for concert tickets. Well, Live Nation sure remembers. And if they don't, we've got the secretly recorded telephone conversation to remind them.
And actually, they were very quick to say, oh, yeah, no, we totally did that.
Yeah, sure.
Because
it's not illegal. The artist wants to sell stuff. There's nothing illegal about it, technically, necessarily. So, yes, the country's largest music promoter put 88,000 Metallica tickets on resale sites like StubHub without giving fans a chance to buy them at face value. So Metallica said, hey, one person with Metallica said, hey, we want to sell these tickets, but we don't want to embarrass ourselves by charging
their manager.
Right, that's
their
tour manager. That's Metallica. Metallica is their manager.
They're claiming, we had no idea this kind of stuff was going on.
Bullshit.
I'm shocked that there's gambling in this facility.
Yes. This does not happen behind your back. I'm sorry. Metallica has a reputation as, you know, righteous and blah, blah, blah. I mean, they're not exactly Pearl Jam.
Well, that's why they do this. They don't want...
Right. Nope. Springsteen did it. Everybody did it. And it's disgusting and they shouldn't do it. But they did. They wanted to charge premium prices. They saw scalpers getting away with it, but they were too embarrassed to do it themselves. So they held back tickets and sold them for resale right away for premium prices. Now they just do it anyway. Now, you know, very few people are Pearl Jam and or Garth Brooks and say, no, we want to have low face value. They charge as much as they can.
Well, you know, everybody, no, I don't know about Springsteen. I only say that because every time I went to see him, I couldn't get a hard ticket. I had to show my ID and the credit card that I used to purchase it. And then I would get a wristband and then have to go into the venue. I couldn't turn around and then sell the wristband.
That has not been his standard policy all over the country. I've seen him. I've never had to do that ever, not once. Never the entire time I've seen him in Madison Square Garden or anywhere else. They never had that because I would love that because that's a great way to make sure it's not resold. Absolutely. I love that.
Yeah. Starting in 1999, that was like,
no, I've seen Springsteen a dozen times. I've never done that. That's never happened. So whatever venue you went to, that's great. I wish everybody would do that. Springsteen does not have that as a policy everywhere on his tour. I don't know why that happened where you saw him. I wish he did do that, but he doesn't consistently. So
yeah,
multiple times. Never have I been forced to show my ID to get into Madison Square Garden. You just show the ticket or the printout of your whatever.
Well, it's certainly Taylor Swift got caught doing it and lots of big acts got caught.
Now they just do it openly.
Yeah, now they kind of say, yeah, okay, well, all right, you know, we're doing it. But now they don't do it at all because instead they just do dynamic pricing and they get what they call the true market value for the ticket.
That's
so
right.
They want to capture every, you know, Live Nation and all of these promoters say, we want to capture the true market value and give that money to the artist, not to the scalpers, the secondhand.
Right, but there are many.
But the reality is the secondhand market was the actual artist in the first place.
Well, not always. There were, of course, lots of scalpers that they hated to fight. But the fact is, if they wanted to keep ticket prices low, they could do what you describe. It's very easy to say you've got to show up with the credit card that you used to purchase the ticket.
Yeah, and there is somebody in Congress, ironically from New Jersey, Bruce Springsteen's hometown.
It's called the Boss Act.
it's called the Boss Act, and here's what it would do. Some of these things are not actually bad. Ban last-second pricing increases and force all-in pricing, okay?
Right, because some people say, it's $100, and then you find out your fees and your tickets, it's $170.
Right, and here's what I like this one. Force a disclosure of how many tickets are actually going on sale. You're kind of playing Madison Square Garden. There's 18,000 seats. That's great. Tickets go on sale. How many tickets are actually going on sale? Because for some reason, when I'm first in line and I wind up getting the last row in the stadium, I kind of wonder how that's even possible since tickets went on sale, 48 seconds ago. And the reason that is because of holdbacks and promotion holdbacks and the, you know, only 10 tickets went on sale.
Right. The fact is, it's a very fixable problem. There shouldn't need to be congressional laws passed. Artists want to charge all they want. That's great, but don't pretend you care about us. Just say you want to get every penny you can. It's not a great idea long-term necessarily. You're Billie Eilish. You don't want to be charging a premium price. You want to build fans for life. And the smart thing to do is play in a venue that's the right size, charge a good price, make sure your fans can get the tickets so that they come to your show. Even if they have to pay $20 a year to be a member of your fan club or $10 a year or just give you their email address, make sure those fans get the tickets and that they come to the show and have to show their ID. And then they become fans for life and they come back again and again. That's what you should do long term, but we can't force you to do that. If you want to charge a premium, great, but don't lie about it.
Well, and you know, U2 does that, but of course, once you buy the ticket, you can then resell it.
Right. So they don't do that. Yeah.
I do like what this congressperson had to say. He said, the Government Accountability Office estimated the primary and secondary ticketing companies charge fees of, get this, 27% and 31% of the ticket price. That's a lot.
Yep.
And I like, and then he goes on to say, in my neighborhood in Paterson, New Jersey, that's called thievery. But that wraps up Inside Baseball for this week and moves us along into some sad news. Rutger Hauer, actor Rutger Hauer, who will always be known as the Replicant, he died at the age of 75.
That's right. He broke through with Paul Verhoeven in TV shows and movies made in their home country. And then he came out to Hollywood and never quite had a huge career. You know, his biggest role is Blade Runner. And that was not a big hit when it came out, but it's certainly a cult film. And he was terrific in it. He also was in The Lady Hawk and Batman Begins, some other stuff. I love him in The Hitcher, which is a really a kind of down and dirty B movie with C. Thomas Howell.
That's a good movie.
Yeah, it's a good dirty little movie. I think it's a real B flick. But you know, he'll be remembered forever for playing the replicant, villain or hero, depending on your point of view, from Blade Runner.
My first two press kits were for The Hitcher and Short Circuit.
Ooh, what a delightful double bill.
Yes, exactly. Sadly, Art Neville of the Neville Brothers.
That's right.
You know, also passed away. I mean, this guy, he's a musical legend.
He is. He's died at the age of 81 after years of declining health. His nickname is Papa Funk. Well, you know you're pretty good if your nickname is Papa Funk. He had a big solo career in the 50s. Then he co-founded the Meters in 1965. And for a decade, they recorded numerous classic albums, and they were practically the house band for New Orleans. They recorded albums for everyone from Alan Toussaint to Lee Dorsey to Dr. John, among many, many, many others. They disbanded around 1977, and Art turned right around and co-founded the Neville Brothers with his siblings, one of the most well-known fixtures on the New Orleans music scene in its own right. That's three big careers in one act, one person. Solo, the Meters, who are legendary, and then the Neville Brothers. So that's a huge career for Art Neville, and he looms large, not just in New Orleans, but popular music.
So what you're saying is those are three big careers. We're slackers, basically.
Oh, yes.
Is what you're saying.
Oh, yes.
Well, that's why you need to subscribe to us in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they get podcasts away for free. Because we're slackers. Yeah, you see, I was trying to transition there, uh-huh. And it was like a speed bump. You just had to just, anyway. Do subscribe to us. Do rate and review us in any one of those podcast aggregators. It does help us out when you do. It helps other people find the show when you do. And in fact, you can find that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find ways to contact us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. You can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. That information, again, is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's writersoftheworldunite.com.
Oh, I see. It's a WGA reference. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, you can find some of my work on celluloidjunkie.com. Until, actually, not next
what?
Week.
Oh,
should have mentioned this at the top. Should have mentioned this at the top of the show. Sorry.
I forgot to ask.
2 weeks from now. Until 2 weeks from now. Play
so
nice.
So we have to. So we have to wait 2 weeks to find out if Old Town Road is number one for 17 weeks in a row. Oh, damn you, Sperling. Damn you.
Well, maybe it'll be number one for 19 weeks.
Oh, God.